Mini episode 855 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 855. You've got FDH Lounge managing partner Rick Morris here today with two of my favorite FDH Lounge dignitaries, Steve Callis and Joe Stazak. Of course, you can hear them on their own podcast every week, which I have been privileged to be a guest on from time to time. Callis Remarks, they generally tape that, I believe, on Tuesdays for the Sportsology Network. Steve Callis can also be heard on such outlets as WFAN, SNY, the STN.net, Joe Stazak, 97.5, the Fanatic in Philadelphia, where he was gracious enough to have me on for some NBA Finals talk recently here from my perspective. So it's good to get to recap this with you guys. Very painful subject matter for me, but who better to do it with than two such great sports talkers. So welcome into the show today here, fellas. Thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure, guys. Great to be with both of you.
I'm going to start by mentioning something, Steve, that I think you as a New Yorker may get a special laugh out of here, that there are just things that happen after an event, and I have gone through in the last several days the first experience of my life of seeing the championship reign of one of my Cleveland teams come to an end, and there are things that just kind of set the mood, and there are songs that appeal to me at different times for reasons that may not seem completely literal, but just something about something that's evocative of it for whatever reason. A song that I hadn't really listened to in many years, but just with the overall downbeat kind of feel of it, and a song that just is sort of like singing about like the end of something here. I have to tell you that the song that has come to my mind, the Downeaster Alexa from Billy Joel, that is a song that has just been, I don't know why. I honestly don't know why, but, you know, I've had it on a loop the last couple of days, fellas. It really captures the mood, and it is not a great mood, but it is a mood of, again, not really shock or anything like that. As had been discussed on your show, Joe, heading into Game 2 after an abysmal Game 1, the notion that, again, when you put Kevin Durant on a team that won 73 games the previous year, there is the expectation in a lot of quarters. It wasn't a firm expectation in my quarters, but I wasn't necessarily shocked either, that, again, such a spectacle would be kind of overwhelming as far as what they would be able to bring to bear, what the Cavs would be able to do to stop them. And as we discussed copiously on your show, the notion of basically pick your poison here, going in terms of if you sag off of the shooters a little bit to cover more on Durant, does he kill you? That's one of those things where there was a lot of talk going in, Joe, and it was on our preview show. My guy Ben Chu had said this. He ultimately picked Cavs in seven, as did I, but he said it's either going to be Warriors in five or Cavs in seven, and you see how it played out. You see how, again, had the Cavs not run out of gas at the end of Game 3 and also gone minus 12 for the 2.5 minutes that LeBron was on the bench, and in Game 5, not to be that guy crying about calls and non-calls, but the non-call on Kevin Durant's third foul, which was pretty ridiculous there, which Kevin Durant being in the game, I think, was key to the monster run that they went on in the second quarter. You look at if the Cavs had forced it back to Cleveland for a Game 6. Again, if it goes to 7 out there in Golden State and they're staring down the barrel of a worse choke than a year ago, I think it's pretty easy to see why people thought that was the fulcrum coming in. Warriors in five, Cavs in seven, and that's exactly the way that it played out.
Yeah, I mean, it did, Rick. Listen, when the story's going to be written about this season. It's going to be written about, you know, one of the top teams to ever play, you know, capped off a near-perfect postseason, you know, with a five-game, felt like a five-game sweep if you think about it, but, you know, except for that anomaly of a game four, I mean, you know, we talked on the air and before game two comes around and Cleveland shoots about 61% in the first quarter and they're down six at the end of the first quarter. In game five, they shot 53% in the first half. They were down 11. You know, it was like Paul Westhead was coaching Golden State with that zero defense, and they can hurt you so quickly and so hard, the punches that they throw. It was very entertaining to watch. And, again, I picked Cleveland. Steve picked Cleveland. I had a bias towards Cleveland. But just watching the performance that they put on, as quickly as they could jump on you and turn your mistakes into points. And, you know, game one, they turned the ball over four times. Cleveland turns it over 20 times. It's a blowout. And then, you know, game two, hanging around a little bit, and boom, you know, it's like a lightning bolt what they did. And then, again, we talked in the NHL segment about swing games. I mean, game three was a huge swing game. You know, they were up. J.R. Smith hits a shot with 3:09 left, puts them up four, and that was it. They didn't score the rest of the way. And then Golden State scores the final 11 points. They go 0-7 from the field, does Cleveland, 3-4 for Golden State, and 4-4 from the line. So they were near perfect. I mean, that's how you have to execute down the stretch. And they didn't wilt in that game. They put themselves in a nice position where they can afford to get bombed like they did. And that almost kind of leaned towards the arguments that Golden State might be the greatest team ever because it needed a performance like that for 24 three-pointers from the field to put away and hand Golden State their first loss of the playoffs. Sometimes, again, you got to tip your cap. There's nothing you're going to do to really prevent 24 three-pointers getting dropped on you, getting rained on you. But I thought Game 5 could go either way. Cleveland was hanging around. I was waiting because I thought some doubt might have been creeping into the minds of the Warriors. But no. You know, at the end of the day, it really didn't. It really didn't matter what LeBron was doing, and he was pretty much doing whatever he wanted to do, especially down the stretch. I mean, Kevin Durant, I mean, every time they needed a big bucket, it was Kevin Durant bombing a three or driving by someone for a dunk, or it was Iguodala. I think the lead was cut to four, and Iguodala knocked down a three late in the fourth quarter, and he came off the bench for 20 points. They didn't wilt at all. You know, they played like champions, and they deserve to be champions.
Well, that's the thing. You talk about Game 4. I will say this. That's a memory that I will always have looking back on that, not least of which because it might be the greatest game that my Cleveland Cavaliers have ever played in franchise history. But it's a thing where, for me on a personal level, I got a chance. I was out of town that weekend. I got a chance to see that game with my nephew, who, although he doesn't live in Cleveland, has a lot of Cleveland blood running through his veins. And it was a big, big thrill watching that game with my nephew Fletcher and the memories that we're going to have of that and of that performance that team had. And again, if nothing else, giving us three more days with the championship from the previous season. And that's all it unfortunately turned out to be. But in looking at this, Steve, it's one of the things I had said coming in, and I thought was going to be an advantage for the Cavs, it turned out not to be. It turned out to be a moot point. I thought in the close games that the Cavs would have the mental toughness edge. They kind of proved it last year. But you look at Game 7, that was a game like Game 3 where the Cavs did very little down the stretch. The thing was, Golden State did nothing down the stretch at Game 7 either. The big difference, of course, this year being Kevin Durant, and there was a very sardonic joke going around in Cleveland after the first two games, like, where's Harrison Barnes when we need him? So you look at the difference in those teams. Golden State, to me, and this is something that it's going to sound bitter for me to use this term, but I don't know any other term to use. They're a front-runner kind of a team. They thrive on getting way up on you, particularly at home with that obnoxious crowd. I find them that way anyways. But anyways, they like that. They feed on being way up on you and being the bully. In close games, now Game 3, you can look at it and say, They beat the Cavs in a close game, but the Cavs ran out of gas. I think that's a different story there. If a team's not hitting any of their shots, it's not necessarily you being clutch. The Cavs, I think, made a lot of unforced errors down the stretch in Game 3, as they did a lot in Game 1. So in looking at this, Steve, again, people are going to say at the end of the day here, scoreboard, they're the champs, they did it. I don't know that we necessarily learned about anything about their ability to play in and prevail in those kind of close, bitter wars in the fourth quarter simply because they were successful in avoiding them.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all. I will say this. I thought there were two plays in this series, two plays, that could have changed the series around. You've already mentioned one, which I'll get to in a minute, when Durant hit LeBron in the head when LeBron dunked on him. But the first one I want to go to is to Game 3, when Cleveland did run out of gas. But what we saw realistically, I thought, was what we saw is LeBron James was going to have to be Will Chamberlain. You know, he was going to have to play 48 minutes a game, and he almost did. But in Game 3, and I think in that specific game, when he played 45 and a half minutes, by the way, he did run out of gas, I thought. But here's the one play I'll focus on in Game 3, and I thought this was the key to the whole game. Cleveland is still up, even though they're collapsing late. They're still up 113-111, and Durant brings the ball up court. Everybody will remember the play. Durant brings the ball up court. He pulls up and makes a three to put them up one with 45 seconds left. Now, it's interesting. The two biggest stars in the game, Durant and LeBron. LeBron says after the game, when Durant takes a three, he moves forward, so it's kind of hard to get up on him because, you know, you might get called for a foul, blah, blah, blah. Durant says, I was dribbling up court. Now, this is a three-point game. I was a two-point game. I was dribbling up court, and I saw that LeBron's heels were behind the three-point line. Took a three. I'm looking at it going, the only way you can lose the lead, because you have to be a moron to foul Durant if he's going to the basket, the only way you can lose the lead is if Durant can pull up for a three. So I thought LeBron, instead of being 2 feet inside, his heels weren't just inside, his feet were inside, he was 2 feet inside the three-point line. I've written articles over the years about defending the three. On that particular play, up three, less than a minute left in the game, he should have been 2 feet outside the three-point line. And if LeBron blows by, if Durant blows by LeBron, which, you know, maybe there's an embarrassment factor there, I don't know. He put right by him and dunks. You're up one with the ball, 40 seconds left. And I thought that was a key play. And I don't know if LeBron was making excuses, because for him to come way back beneath the three-point line, and he was a good 2-3 feet beneath the three-point line, which made Durant's three not even like one of those 5 feet behind the line threes. So I thought that was a big key in the game. And once they made that, obviously they didn't get the lead back. Kyrie Irving took an ill-advised, as great as he was, and he was great, took an ill-advised fall-away three over Klay Thompson. If you remember the three he made last year, Rick, and I'm sure you did, it was on a switch with Curry.
Yep.
As great as Curry is offensively, he spent this series running away from those switches. He did everything to not switch. And last year, they got the switch. Kyrie made the three. This year, on that particular play, after Durant hit the three, Kyrie dribbled around for like 12 seconds and then took a fall-away three over 6'6", 6'7", Klay Thompson, and just couldn't make it. So I thought the first key play of that game was a very simple one. If LeBron gets above the three and Durant goes by them scores a two, you know, the game is tied, you have the ball. So I thought that was a huge mistake. The second one is the one you mentioned, which I thought was a gigantic play. Durant had two fouls. LeBron, who had some vicious dunks, and I thought the officiating was bad both ways. I think LeBron is like Shaq, if you go back far enough, a little bit like Wilt. Even though he's not as big as Shaq or Wilt, he's a monster. He's a 6'8 monster and 7'7 foot monster, and he gets hammered going to the basket. I don't know if the refs don't call it because they don't see it or because he scores anyway and he's so strong, but when he went to the basket on that play, 10-13 left in the second quarter, he dunks on Durant. Durant hits him in the head. They go up eight, you'll recall, and there was a timeout right after that, I think, and LeBron went right up to the ref and pointed to his head. He said, he hit me in the head. Now, if you go back a couple games before, you'll recall, Kevin Love went to block Durant, made a play on the ball, hit him in the head. The refs called a foul, and Durant went up to him and said, he hit me in the head. That's a flagrant. And you recall, they went to the table, and they called a flagrant on Kevin Love.
Yep.
Now, so think about that. Had they called the foul on Durant, which was clearly a foul, you hit a guy in the head when he's dunking, that's a foul. That's his third foul. He goes off the court. And now you'll know, Rick, and this would be my Tyronn Lue coaching complaint. They then went on a 21-2 run, and Tyronn Lue called one timeout during that. They went from 8 down, from Cleveland went from 8 up to 13 down in the span of like 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. So he did call a timeout. I thought he should have called 2 or 3. And I thought the game was lost there, even though it was a game late, as you said and Joe said, even though it was a game late, Cleveland never had the ball with a chance to take the lead.
Right.
They got it to 4, they got it to 3, they got it to 6, but they never could quiet every time down one of these guys, like Joe said, Iguodala hit a 3. You know, the amazing thing about this series was that they had exactly the same field goal percentage from 3, yet every time Murray or Durant or Thompson took a 3, you thought it was going in. You didn't really think that for Cleveland. They don't really have that guy. When LeBron got stripped by Iguodala at the end of Game 3, they had to take a 3, and I'm looking there. There's nobody who you're going to put the ball in their hands and say, he's making the 3. Golden State has 3 guys you can put the ball in their hands and you'll say, he's making the 3. So I don't know if LeBron got fouled by Iguodala or not. He didn't complain. But I thought he kind of strafed him on the side. Not that LeBron could have made 3 foul shots, because he's not a, you know, I've said this a number of times, LeBron's the greatest player who ever lived if he could shoot from the outside. If he could shoot like Kevin Durant, he'd be the greatest player ever. But some days he can, and some days he can't. So I thought it was those two plays, the lack of defense on Durant in game 3, and then when Durant hit LeBron in the head, the no call. And I thought that could have been a 7-game series, which is what I thought. Did I think Golden State could win in 5? Yeah, maybe. But I thought it was going to be Cleveland in 7 as well.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of us thought was the fulcrum of whether it goes 5 or it goes 7. That was probably going to determine who won. But what's interesting, and I want to pick up on that a little bit there in terms of what you're saying. Again, the Cavs, down the stretch, game 3 again. First of all, getting cold, and then something I referenced on Joe's show talking about game 1, when the game started to get out of hand, the Cavs just absolutely went on tilt. And in the last minute there, it was like flipping a switch. When Durant put Golden State in the lead, it was panic as far as what happened with fumbling the ball out of bounds, with Kyrie's shot. It was a little bit of repeating itself there, of just going on tilt, pressing too hard in the moment when Durant hit the shot, and they were only down 1 point at that point, but it was like they thought it was over as soon as Durant hit that one there. But you look at this, though, and again, I'm not cherry-picking when I say throw out the first 2 games for the purpose of what I'm going to say next, because the Cavs actually lost the first 2 games somehow or another last year in Golden State worse than they lost the first 2 games this year. We forget about that, but these 2 games, as bad as they were actually closer. Games 3, 4, 5, you look at that again, part of it is the anomaly, as Joe has said, but it is true of how much the Cavs spanked Golden State in Game 4, but the Cavs, with a collective, albeit narrow, point edge in Games 3, 4, 5, and looking at that there, I say all that to say this, that I feel differently about the series at the end of it than I did after Game 2. That was the trigger, it seemed like, for a lot of all this talk of OMG, must trade Love for Paul George, must do this, that, which again, my first question is, how do you replace the rebounding, if nothing else? Plus, Paul George plays the same position as LeBron. LeBron has resisted playing excessive minutes at the 4. Somebody's got to play the 4 somewhat out of position if that happens. So my sense in looking at this, Steve, I'll start with you on this, is that I think it would be an overreaction. I know that Love is the one asset that you can move, who other teams are going to want, who you can get something for. But again, while I think the Cavs clearly need to make upgrades, I think it would be the wrong move to push the panic button. Yes, Golden State is a team for the ages, and this incarnation of this team wasn't going to be able to take them out. But my sense is this may very well be peak Warriors. People assume they're only going to get better and better. We're coming up on the age 30 seasons for Durant and Curry, who've both had issues with staying healthy from time to time. I think panic, in light of the way the last 3 games of the series went, would be a bad move. Upgrades are necessary, I believe, but I would say nothing drastic. What say you, Steve?
not sure what they can do. They don't have a lot of cap space. They're talking about trying to get somebody real good with the, you know, that mid exception, that $5 or $7 million exception. You're going to have to find a guy who wants to win a championship, and I'm not saying this guy would be enough, but like a David West going to Golden State for a lot less money. I think it's going to be very tough to beat them next week. Next year, you're right, all these guys could be or are somewhat injury prone. If this is a dynasty, and maybe two out of three finals is the beginnings of a dynasty in the modern day, you know, sports or modern day NBA, I don't think Cleveland is tremendously far away. But again, you have to have LeBron James being the miracle worker. He has to go 45, 46, 47 minutes a game. I don't know if that's realistic. I noticed a change after the first two games when he was playing that amount of time and going to the basket. You're recalling games before, he was essentially the point forward bringing the ball up, and he did not shoot a lot at the beginning of that game. He definitely didn't drive to the basket as much, and I think he clearly did that knowing he was going to have to play virtually the whole game in games 3 and 4. You didn't get the hellacious LeBron that you got games 1 and 2, because he did run out of gas at the end, as did most of the Cavs of game 2, I'm talking about. Of game 3, when had something happened at the end, that game could have gone either way. And as we talked about with Joe a lot, that would have been a series then, because there would have been a game 6 in Cleveland had they won game 3, of course. But I don't know that they can beat them next year. I don't know that I don't think Paul George is the answer. I certainly don't think Carmelo Anthony is the answer. Kevin Love, you can say, you know, Stephen A. Smith afterwards, oh, they could have had Wiggins instead of Love, and that's what they needed. You know, he did everything but call him a slow white guy, but he doesn't remember what Kevin Love did defensively in Game 7 last year, defensive set for the ages, you know, not just the LeBron block, not just the Kyrie shot, but the Kevin Love defense. So it would be hard to give up Love. I mean, he's happy being the number 3 guy. He doesn't complain. He's a great rebounder, not a good rebounder. He's the best outlet passer in the NBA. So I just don't know what moves they can make, Rick, to get enough. And I don't think if you look at Paul George and Carmelo as maybe answers, if you have to give up Love for them, they're not the answer. And even if you don't, you know, Carmelo is essentially a 3. So what's going to happen then? So do I think they can win next year? I think they have a chance. You know, Adam Silver said it's not a two-team league. He's full of baloney. If it's not a two-team league, all it could be is a three-team league, because you have to throw the Spurs in there after what they did for 2.5 quarters before Leonard got hurt. But I just don't think there's much around. And nobody, I think, in the history of the world will ever add a Kevin Durant. Again, they added Durant. I wrote laughingly in the late 90s that if Patrick Ewing really wants to win a title, when he was going to Seattle, when he wasn't going to beat the Bulls, he should sign with the Bulls for the minimum. And, you know, that was kind of a laughing thing last year. But what did Durant do? They got the second best player in the game, this Paul Pierce. We're seeing a changing of the guard. Durant's better than LeBron. That's ridiculous right now, because he can't defend like LeBron defends. He doesn't rebound like LeBron does. But he's a much better shooter than LeBron. But he's not better than LeBron. So I don't know that anyone's ever going to add a Durant. Durant went right to the top of that class. I mean, Curry was kind of put into the background a little. He played great offensively. Klay Thompson, you know, kind of got pushed back. But they all want to stay there, and I think they're going to be the top team in the next two or three years at least. I think the Cavs can make a run, but I think it's going to be very hard, because I just don't know. They're not adding a Durant-like player, but they need to add hopefully a defender, like maybe even the Jimmy Butler type guy who has had some relative success against Durant. But you need some guys who can defend as well, and that's what I would be looking for if I were the Cavaliers.
Well, and that's where, again, you've already got Derek Williams on the roster. They didn't feel like throwing him in there this time around. Maybe by this time next year, he's enough in the rotation. He's going to be in there. Eddie Tavares, another young guy, rim defender, who, again, he was injured, would not play in the finals. Maybe they're going to go with some youth in there, as well as trying to bring in a big-ticket guy or two if they can manage it. Joe, I'm curious for your thoughts on this, because, again, the I even for me, this would be poor taste if I equated a Steph Curry injury with saying the optimist in me. But I will say that I do think that, again, he's about to get $40 million a year. That $40 million a year becomes an albatross if he gets hurt. Because you're right back where you started a year ago here. You could say, okay, well, Durant is better than Curry. But in looking at this, with the money that Golden State is going to be giving to these guys, the amount of tax that they're going to be paying on that, they're going to be as hemmed in cap-wise as the Cavs are presently. So in terms of looking at the totality of this, how the series played out, how drastic do you think the Cavs need to get in order to try to close the gap any?
I think they have some serious work to do, and I know you guys say, well, they can't add a Kevin Durant. He's got one more year left. Well, why can't he sign Durant after next year and have him teamed up with LeBron? I know they both play the same position. They said that facetiously. My bigger question, Rick, and I'm not skirting the question, but I want to throw this back to you. LeBron has another year left. Is he going to stick around Cleveland? And I'm going to ask you this when I have you on my show this Saturday, if you can make it, but is he going to stick around?
Well, I tell you what, that is a very interesting question. The national media, of course, is doing their best to fan the flames. And I'm going to note with a lot of bitterness that I felt a year ago how backhanded it was. Oh, we feel so good for Cleveland. Oh. You know, you got a-holes out there like J.A. Adonde, who, when LeBron was about to make his decision, said he shouldn't go back to Cleveland, because J.A. Adonde outright made it a racial thing and said that would be a disservice to black people if he goes back and plays for Dan Gilbert again. And really, J.A. Adonde was just showing his cards more than a lot of them were. Nobody in the national media, as I'm talking the ESPNs, Fox Sports 1, whatever, nobody felt good for Cleveland. I mean, they had to say that in the moment. They had to act magnanimous. This is the true colors right now. We're right back to, oh, if only LeBron gets out of that backwater Cleveland and moves on to a real city like Miami or Los Angeles or somewhere. So don't minimize the extent of that in all of this, Joe, because that is driving this a lot. The whole snobbery of nobody wants to believe in 2017 that the mountain can come to Muhammad, but it can. And I've told this story previously on air. I actually, of all things, made a Facebook friend recently in the Philippines from one of these things from the Cavs Facebook page. They have Facebook followers all over the world. You're talking to people all over the world. And I'm not naive enough to think that before LeBron came back here, any of these people were Cavs fans. But they are. The mountain can come to Muhammad. It's 2017. And as much as the national media wants to think otherwise, there's no imperative for him to leave. He's got his first kid going to be in high school. He's never indicated that he is staying. And I'm not saying that he is staying, but there are things that he has said that make you believe that he would rather not pick up and leave all over again. He might. But there is that other side of the coin that nobody is talking about, to where does he really want to do this again at this age with his kids, with his family?
How much heat would he take if he did decide to take off and maybe try another run? He gets frustrated in Cleveland and maybe tries to make another run with somewhat of a super team, maybe another run to, I think he cares about his legacy more than maybe other things that people think or that he wants to let on, that he might not say it or whatever, but I think he wants to catch Mike and his rings. I mean, how much heat would he take if he did decide to split and go somewhere like he did before in Miami?
Well, again, you have somebody like Adrian Wojnarowski with his seething hatred of all things Cleveland fanning the flames here. And, oh, so he won a title and now he doesn't owe them anything. Look, there is a certain amount of that. The venom would be nowhere near what it was in 2010 because he has delivered. And, I mean, I speak personally for myself in that regard as well, because I had a lot of resentment in 2010. And so did a lot of people, because as the guy who basically was the de facto GM of this roster, they built a roster that was not very promising in at least the medium term, because it was getting old with a lot of the assets. But he kept putting the gun to their head. And, OMG, better go for it all this year. You don't want me to leave in 2010. And then he did leave in 2010 anyways, citing, among other things, an insufficient roster. So the circumstances when he left were really pretty odious. And I say that now without any sense of venom. I said personally all was forgiven when he won the championship. I think a lot of people feel that way too. There's going to be tremendous disappointment if it happens, but also the notion, too, he's not going to hold up forever. That next contract, somebody is going to start to get, because it's going to be 5 years for the Supermax. They're going to get the declining years of LeBron into his late 30s. We've still got Kyrie here. We've still got Love. And Cleveland has shown that it can be a magnet at this point because of LeBron to try to get other talent in. The desire to play and win with Kyrie and Love is still going to be here, or Paul George, or if Love gets moved. So, no, it's an interesting thing here. But, again, I would caution everybody, as somebody who lives in Cleveland and who kind of sees all sides of the coin here, as opposed to the mouth breather, national media takes, that it's more complicated, I think, than people think. There will be probably some drama in the summer of 2018, but I think not nearly as much as people are believing that there will be. ESPN, FS1, they want to drive their ratings, they want to drive their page clicks, and LeBron drama about where he's going to play is very good for doing that. But so having addressed that, I want to ask, and I'll start with you, Joe, any other thoughts coming out of this series, anything we haven't touched upon? I mean, this is one of these things where, again, it kind of seems cut and dry based on how it went. I mean, Golden State clearly ranks among the greatest single-season teams of all time. People are talking about them with the 86 Celtics, the 96 Bulls, whatever. Whatever anybody thinks, they're clearly in that discussion. I stand by what I said on your show going into Game 2. This is the best team that LeBron's ever played on. And yet the Cavs still lost in five in the end, as close as it was to going longer than that. So for me, it's pretty cut and dried of a story coming out of this thing here. And we've touched on a lot of elements, but I'm still curious to see, starting with you, Joe, if there's other elements that you have in mind.
I think they need help. Anything they need bench help. I'm not saying anything that's groundbreaking. I think they need to have more weapons from the outside. I mean, you hear about Kyle Korver being such a deadly three-point shooter. He was relatively ineffective, in the finals. J.R. Smith decided to come alive in Game 5, but other than that, he was inconsistent. Tristan Thompson didn't wake up till Game 4. I just think they need some help. I don't think they're that close to Golden State, to be honest with you. I know they had a nice season, probably the de facto number one seed in the East. I know they kind of hit the brakes a little bit. It didn't matter. I mean, they absolutely destroyed and dismantled Boston on, their floor for the most part. So clearly the best team in the East. They need some help. I mean, you talk about Andrew Wiggins, they didn't... LeBron plays the same position, all right? Kevin Love was a good choice. I think they did the right thing by bringing Kevin Love in. And they do have their version of the big three. Kyrie, just a tremendous, tremendous guard. You saw what he can do when he's on his game, when he's dialed in, when he's in that zone. He's unstoppable. LeBron, unstoppable when he's in that zone, when he's dialed in. Kevin Love, a little inconsistent, but they need more surrounding help. LeBron, I know, was complaining earlier in the season that they needed more help around the big three. And, they got healthy, but they're just not good enough to compete with Golden State as they are built right now. I don't know what to do. You look at the unrestricted free agents, the shooters out there. I mean, J.J. Redick might be the best of the lot. Kyle Korver's unrestricted, but he's already, part of the squad. It's hard to say how you get better, and because, that's the standard. You have to now chase Golden State. You have to somehow be better than Golden State, or you're going to end up in the same position you were. And Golden State's not going anywhere. LeBron played in his 14th season this year. By the time Durant plays in his 14th season, it'll be 2021. Steph Curry, it'll be 2023. These guys have a lot of more mileage left on their legs. LeBron's played in seven straight finals. At some point, he's going to start declining. I don't know when that is, but they need some help, and they need it fast. I honestly don't know what they can do. I mean, I hear the Paul George thing for Kevin Love. I don't see that happening, but... I don't think it's time to push the panic button. Anything can happen. Injuries can happen, things like that. But right now, apples to apples, they are clearly not that close to Golden State.
Well, and again, they are building with one team in mind, and they don't ever want to say this publicly. You don't want to unnecessarily give bulletin board material to anybody, but a team that went a combined, 36-5 in the East Conference playoffs the last 3 years. They're building with one team in mind. I have two thoughts on that. Number one, Got to lock down David Griffin. This is a thing where Dan Gilbert is playing Russian roulette here. And, again, he has starved him out of interviewing for so many other jobs. Griff, though, is a very prideful guy. Not overly so, but appropriately so, as one of the best general managers in the league. He's just as likely to say, screw you, I'll go work for ESPN or TNT for a year and come back and have my pick of jobs next year. So Dan Gilbert needs to quit screwing around and lock down this excellent GM. Another thing is, I don't think I said this on air last year. I wish I had the foresight to say this on air instead of off air. I had an observation a year ago. Dan Gilbert needs to hire one employee. I don't know if it's a retired coach, retired scout, who it is. You lock him in a closet, and all that guy does is watch Golden State film every day. And you just have one dedicated employee. If it was true a year ago, it's that much more true now. They need to have at least one employee, and I wouldn't acknowledge it publicly that that's their job, because, again, you don't want to give the rest of the league bulletin board material, but that's what you got to do. Steve, do you have any closing thoughts coming out of the finals?
I think my closing thoughts would be more on the future and with LeBron. I have to say, after Game 3, when he started saying things like, you know, I was never on a super team, this is a super team, clearly seeing defeat, not that he gave up, they played great in Game 4, but I think the future for LeBron is this, frankly, and I'll defer to you being in Cleveland, but I will say this. I think it's true that they now can bring in a top-flight free agent, but they can't do it this year. And I don't know what their cap space is going to be next year. So I don't know who they're going to get, as we said before and as Joe said, who they're really going to get that's going to put them over the hump. They might have to just play a lot better with what they have. I don't know if that's enough, because the same problems you had with Golden State this year, barring injury, you're going to have the same problems with them next year. So are you going to let Kevin Durant go down the lane uncontested for five dunks, because literally guys were running out to the three-point line while Kevin Durant was going down the middle to dunk? Or are you going to go and get Durant and leave these guys who hit threes like they're foul shots? I shouldn't say that part, but you know what I'm saying. But I think here's the interesting thing. I think if they can't beat Golden State next year, or at least take them to seven or something, if they don't improve, as Joe was saying, I think at the end of next year, LeBron says right then and there, he tries to pull over. See, I can't even pick the superstar now. There's no Durant out there, you know. Right. And again, Carmelo doesn't do it for me. Paul George doesn't do it for me. There's very few guys. If you could get a Jimmy Butler who maybe can defend Durant a little bit and then get a star next year, I don't know if you can. But I think at the end of next year, what LeBron's going to say is either, I can get this guy, bring him to Cleveland, and we can win, or if he can't say that, Rick, I think he might say, look, I only got a few years at a high level left. I might have to go somewhere else. And I know that'll be a tough decision, but it will be really a 1 or 2 year decision. I don't see LeBron playing more than 3 more seasons at the level he's at. I don't even know if he can do 3, but he's already got 1 in the books next year, and then he'll have 1 or 2 more after that. He might want to go chase. I don't think he can get to 6, as Joe was saying. I don't think, and even if he got the 6, then it would be, oh, he's 6-5, not 6-0, like Michael.
Right.
But I think he's going to make that decision not this year, but at the end of next year. And if he thinks they can't get there, he said he's never played on a super team. I would disagree with that. He's the originator of the super team down in Miami, frankly, and also in Cleveland, you know. But now, as I've talked about with Joe a lot, instead of big threes, in the old days it was big twos. It was Michael and Scotty, it was Shaq and Kobe. LeBron made it the big three, and now Golden State made it the big four, because I do count Draymond Green as part of a big four. And I think LeBron at the end of next year is going to look at what's going on, and if he can't bring someone that he thinks will come here and beat Golden State, then I think he might very well go somewhere else for just a year or two to try and beat Golden State. I don't think he'll go to Golden State for the minimum, as I said with Patrick Ewing. But I do think he's going to look, because I think at the end of the day he wants to win. He's fulfilled his promise to Cleveland, and I don't think that would be moving his family, Rick. But he won one. You might look back, and like I look back at the Rangers, one cup in 54 years, but now it's 23 years later. Where's the next one? But at least you got one. And so I think that'll be interesting, but I think the interest will really be at the end of next year, and I think he will make the decision. If he doesn't think he can bring someone in to beat Golden State, I do think he he'll give a lot of thought to leaving just for 1 or 2 years, because that's all he'll have left at the level he's at.
Very possibly. I guess I'll agree to disagree with you. And even though this is a guy I don't like, it doesn't mean I don't think it's true. I think Danny Ainge is the guy who opened Pandora's box on the super team with the big three in Boston. So I'll lay the blame at his feet rather than Riley and LeBron. Because I think they were just following in those footsteps. That's just my perspective on it. But anyways, as I knew it would be, a very stimulating discussion of, not my favorite topic right now, in looking back on the 2017 NBA Finals. But duty summons us all. And so, gentlemen, I appreciate the chance to have you guys on and get your perspectives on this. Joe, Steve, thank you both so much for being on.
Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it. It was fantastic. Had a great time. Hope we do it again soon.
Absolutely. We'll have to reconvene soon. And again, for the occasion of the 2017 NBA Finals, great recap with you gentlemen. Thank you for being on. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge mini episode number 855.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.